Yes, we've been looking at, we're doing a series that started last week looking at Buddhist texts in order to, well, we're going to just unpack a few of the kind of really basic Buddhist texts, give you maybe a flavour of what's inside so that you can inspire your own practice and go and read for yourself. But also because just communicating key Dharmic ideas through Buddhist texts throughout the ages. And last week, I gave a very reduced history of Buddhism and the texts that apply to Buddhism. 2,500 years in, actually I have to say it was a little on the long side, that talk, but you know, in about 50 minutes or something. So, and just introducing the texts and how they fit in with them, with each other, because actually, you know, a lot of these texts, if you aren't kind of introduced to how they fit in with Buddhist history, they can seem confusing and at worst contradictory. But if you understand where they're coming from, actually it's easier to understand the texts themselves. So if you didn't listen, if you weren't here last week, I do recommend actually that you might get that CD out of the library and actually listen to it. Or, you know, familiarise yourself a bit with Buddhist history. Haha. Read Eternal Legacy if you've got about a week with nothing else to do in it. But anyway, so I gave this kind of cut-down version of how all these things fitted in. And I said, well, what we're going to do probably from now until Christmas is we're going to look at the earliest texts of the Buddhist tradition, which are the reported sayings of the Buddha himself. So we're going to be looking at some of those texts, which are the stories of the historical Buddha and what the historical Buddha said himself. And when we were talking about this scheme, Suri, Matti and Vidanya had this bright idea. They said, well, you know, we should start off with the life of the Buddha. But we're not here that week, Vajratara, so you're going to have to do it. And if there's one thing I don't like giving talks on, it's like really big subjects put into one small amounts of time, which I did last week, but 2 weeks is just too much, actually. So I said, okay, I'll do the life of the Buddha, but I'm going to do just his early life, and I'm going to base it on one sutta, on one discourse, sutta meaning discourse or thread. So, and I chose that sutta out of the middle length sayings, not the long sayings. And actually, I'm only going to do half that sutta anyway, so there you go. So the sutta I'm going to be looking at this evening is the Aripariyasana Sutta, which is the Noble Search. Sometimes it's called the Noble Search. But I'll say a bit more about what those words actually mean in a minute. And what's quite good is if you look in the actual Pali Canon, in the earliest stories of the Buddha, and you look at the life stories of the Buddha in the earliest, in their earliest forms, they're very, very simple. And you see that a lot of the early life of the Buddha gets mythologized, gets drawn out, different sequences get put in the later traditions. But actually the earliest ones are very, very simple. So this is quite a major sutta, quite a major story about the Buddha's search for enlightenment. But it's very, very simple. And I think in some ways that can make it more accessible to us. In some ways it doesn't. In some ways, you know, some of these stories can seem a little terse, a little kind of blunt. And maybe I was writing this to her and I was thinking, God, is this just really heavy? But actually, if you really dwell on it, if you really look at these very simple stories, actually it can unfold in your own reflections. And really you can apply it to your own life in a very human sort of a way. So it can be more accessible to just hear this very, very simple story of the Buddha's early life. So this sutta, I really like this sutta because it has a very, very beautiful introduction, very lovely introduction. And what happens is some of the followers of the Buddha, they go to Ananda, and who's the Buddha's, who's the Buddha's companion, sort of full-time companion. And they say to the Buddha, friend Ananda. Now you get this impression, Ananda's a very, very popular chap. And he often actually acts as a kind of in-between the Buddha and his followers. Sometimes people come and tell Ananda things. And Ananda subtly tells the Buddha at a later date. So he's obviously a great friend to people in the Pali Canon, in the stories of the Pali Canon. He's a great friend. And they say, "Friend Ananda, it is long since we heard a talk. It is long since we heard the Dharma from the Blessed One's own lips. It would be good if we could hear such a talk, friend Ananda." So they suggest to Ananda that they would like to hear a discourse from the Buddha himself. So Ananda says, "Well, if you meet me a little bit later at Ramaka's hermitage, maybe you'll hear a talk from the Blessed One's own lips." So then it moves to Ananda, the Blessed One comes along, and Ananda's with the Blessed One. And at a certain point, they bathed in the river, and Ananda said, "Well, you know what? Ramaka's hermitage is really nearby here. Suppose we just go and spend the evening in Ramaka's hermitage." And the Buddha complies with this idea, and off they set to Ramaka's hermitage. And surprise, surprise, the whole place is filled with the followers of the Buddha. And they're all talking Dharma. They're all talking about the Buddha's discourses. They're all talking about the truth, the way things are. And the Buddha, he comes across this. I wonder if the Buddha suspects what's going on here. One never knows. But anyway, he doesn't mind. He goes up to Ramaka's hermitage, and he hears them talking about the Dharma. He stands outside, and he waits till a suitable break in the conversation, and he knocks on the door and coughs, and they invite him in. And he says to them, "Well, what are you doing?" And they said, "Well, we're talking about the Dharma. We're talking about, you know, your teachings. We're talking about you. We're talking about the way things are." And he says, "Very good, very good." He says, "When you gather together, you should do either of two things: hold discussion on the Dharma or maintain noble silence." So, which is interesting. I don't think I've managed that ever. But I think it's very worth reflecting on this. I don't think the Buddha means that everything that you say has got to be brought back to Buddhism. It's a bit like, you know, "Well, I made some really nice scones today." Well, that's interesting because, you know, in the Buddha's day, people didn't eat scones. So is it really going to help you gain enlightenment to eat those scones? I mean, the Buddha didn't need scones to gain enlightenment. You know, right, okay. So let's not have conversations as strange as that in the Buddhist centre. I don't think you need to go that far. And I don't think you need to go as far as saying you're never allowed to say anything light-hearted. You know, everything's got to be heavy and really about the truth. I think what it means is be mindful of your speech. Be mindful of what you're saying. Don't waste your energy on saying things that either don't matter or that actually cause harm to yourself and harm to others. And remember, I said about the Pali Canon last week that it's very, very simple. You know, the Buddha just says again and again, he says, "Does it lead to sorrow, lamentation, grief or despair, or does it lead to liberation? Does it lead to the well-being of others and to yourself, or does it lead to suffering to yourself and others?" And in a way, you've got to bear that in mind when you speak. Is this leading to people's well-being? Is it making other people happy? Is it helping other people to grow? Or is it actually sending this atmosphere down? Is it making a kind of downward atmosphere? So anyway, so that's what he says. He just says, you know, when you gather together, you should either speak the Dharma, speak the truth, speak what's meaningful and what helps people to grow and is of benefit to others, or don't speak at all. So so that's quite a big teaching. But anyway, so he says that. And then he sits down and he starts telling them a story, basically. And I really, really love the beginning of this story because it gives an impression of the Buddha, that he, of just how well and loved and respected the Buddha was. You know, that his followers, it will be a bit like, you know, they just decide, "Oh, it'd be just really great to hear the Buddha speak. It'd be really lovely to hear the Buddha speak." They don't have an idea what they want him to speak on. They'd just like him to speak. They'd just like to be with the Buddha and hear him speak the truth. And in comes the Buddha, and he's very happy to do this. Very delighted that his followers are just speaking the Dharma, speaking the truth. And he sits down, and he starts telling them about his life. And quite a lot of the life story of the Buddha comes out in this way. It comes out later, in this very gentle way that, you know, they just ask him to speak on something. And he says, "Yeah, okay, I'll tell you a bit about my life." And you can imagine them, they're just being really pleased to hear from the Buddha. So what the Buddha starts saying is, he says that, well, there's two kinds of search, the noble and the ignoble search. So he says this, he says, the noble search and the ignoble search. And what is the ignoble search? Here, someone being himself subject to birth seeks what is also subject to birth. Being himself subject to aging, he seeks what is also subject to aging. Being himself subject to sickness, he seeks what is also subject to sickness. Being himself subject to death, he seeks what is also subject to death. Being himself subject to sorrow, he seeks what is also subject to sorrow. Being himself subject to defilement, he seeks what is also subject to defilement. Okay, so that's the ignoble search. You could also say it's a bit like the worldly search, the worldly life. And in a way, it's not very easy to immediately understand what he's trying to say here, but these are just a few reflections. It's not immediately apparent what it means, but I think this is the way I think about it. What I think it means is that we're always looking for the familiar. What is subject to sorrow seeks what is subject to sorrow. What is subject to defilement, which in this case would be greed, hatred and delusion, seeks what is subject to greed, hatred and delusion. We're always looking for a situation that's familiar to us, that backs up our state of mind, that in a way colludes and supports our state of mind, whatever our state of mind is. And interestingly enough, the Buddha puts this in the context of others. He puts this in the context of other people and animals. So what he's saying is, I'll give you a little quote actually. He says, and what may be said to be subject to sorrow? Wife and children are subject to sorrow. Men and women slaves, goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares are subject to sorrow. So what he's saying is that in a way we can use other people and we can use animals as acquisitions. So what is subject to sorrow? Ourselves. We suffer and we try to cling on to what is also subject to sorrow. So he's talking about the way in which we try and own other people and we try and own animals. And we try and own all our possessions. We try and acquire things to ourselves that are like ourselves. We try and build this world around ourselves to reinforce our mental habits that are similar to our mental habits. And we get tied to these things. We get infatuated with these things. And we get utterly committed to these things. That's his word. Getting tied, infatuated and utterly committed. So he's not saying that there's anything wrong with people and animals in themselves. Remember, he's talking about wives and children because he's talking to a group of men. If he was talking to a group of women, he'd say husbands and children. He's not talking about animals and people in themselves, obviously, because the Buddha spent his whole life in relation to others, searching for the truth with others and trying to spread the truth to others. And he did that to all people, lay people. He did that with prostitutes. He did that with beggars. He did that with homeless wanderers. He did that with kings. He did that with queens. Whoever came to him and asked him for teachings, he'd give them the teachings. So he's not saying that there's anything wrong with people or animals in themselves. He's saying that on the basis of our own greed, hatred and delusion, we try to cling on to things that are the same as us, that are also that also are subject to greed, hatred, delusion and sorrow. We try to own things, we try to have them. We're always attracted towards the familiar. And I think in a way, what he's asking you to do is be very honest about the way in which we try and own people to make ourselves feel better. That's what he's talking about. He's talking about trying to own things to make ourselves feel better. And we do this with people. as well as with things. So it's quite a pokey teaching, this, actually. And, you know, it reminds me of sometimes when you're listening to the radio or something, and you hear all these songs, like love songs, and they're all about someone being mine. And in a way, that's just part of everyday language, isn't it? Someone being yours. Well, actually, no one can be yours. You can't own another human being. You can't even really own an animal. You can try and cling on to these things and want them to remain the same, but they won't remain the same. And they are subject, as he says, to birth, to aging, to sickness, to death, to sorrow, to greed, to hatred, delusion. All those things will be experienced by humanity as a whole and even by animals. And maybe you don't really realise how much you think you own something until it's gone. I did have this experience, which I've actually found quite humiliating, when I split up from my last boyfriend. And every time I kind of had this, you know, this huge amount of grief would come up, and then I'd think, well, what's going on there? And I was really humiliated to find that part of me was upset. Not all of me, but there was a part of my experience that I was upset because I used to own him and now I didn't anymore. He used to be mine. You know, people could have said of us that, he was my boyfriend and I was his girlfriend. And there was something about owning another human being in there, which I found deeply humiliating, that actually I still clung on to that idea that we could own someone, that I could own someone. And it really only surfaced when it all ended. So in a way, he's saying it's all right. It's all right as far as it goes, that something that's subject to sorrow should seek something that's also subject to sorrow, that we should seek the familiar, that we should be comforted by the familiar. He says that in a way, that's all right. It's all right as far as it goes. But there's two problems with this. And the first is that if we're attracted to just what's familiar, there can be no progress. It's going to be like the blind leading the blind. And we can end up just using each other to reinforce our old habits, to move in the same circles, to never move beyond the familiar and to never move into the unknown. We can use each other just to kind of reinforce what is familiar to us. So if us subject to sorrow is also constantly seeking what is also subject to sorrow, there can be nothing other than sorrow, in a way. There can be no progress. And the other thing is that what is familiar to us is what is conditioned and impermanent. What is familiar to us cannot give us lasting satisfaction. So what he's saying that's wrong with this kind of whole search is that we're looking, in a way, what we're looking for is permanence and substantiality in things that are impermanent and insubstantial. We're looking for, security in things that can never give us security. He's saying that people, animals, things are born, they age, they get sick, they get broken, they die, they end up on the tip. You know, you can't cling on to security in those things. If you want to be free from sorrow, don't look for something that also suffers. Don't look for something that is also sorrowful. If you want to be free from death, don't look for something that's going to die. If you want permanency, don't look for impermanent things. So it's interesting that in the list that he talks about of things that we try and acquire to gain security, he also includes gold and silver in birth and aging. And I was thinking, well, gold and whose mummy gold and whose father silver? How does that work? How can gold and silver born and die? Well, what he's saying actually is that they're conditioned. Given a certain conditions, gold comes into being. And then it goes out of being as well. He's saying that actually things as well as people, as well as animals, all those things that we try and cling on to for our security are changing all the time. given certain conditions they come into being, and given certain conditions they go out of being as well. They can't provide any lasting satisfaction. So that's the ignoble search, is trying to get security, trying to get permanency out of things that can't be permanent and that can't give you security. It's this whole method of trying to acquire things in order to be happy, in order to be secure. And that includes things as much as people and animals. So the Buddha recognized that ignoble search and started then to talk about the noble search. So what he says is this. He says, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, which is basically means a Buddha before he's a Buddha. It's someone who's practicing the perfections in order to become a Buddha. I too, being myself subject to birth, sought what was also subject to birth. Being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow and defilement, I saw what was also subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow and defilement. Then I considered thus, why, being myself subject to birth, do I seek what is also subject to birth? Why, being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow and defilement, do I also seek what is subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow and defilement? Suppose that, being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, I seek the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Suppose that myself, being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow and defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow and defilement, I seek the unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless and undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana. So in a way, what he's doing is he's looking at what's on offer in his life. And in the Buddha's life, a lot was on offer for him. He had a beautiful wife, he had dancing girls, he had palaces for every season. He had as much power as anyone could have in his realms. He had it all. And he looked at all that was on offer for him in his life. And he asked, well, why? Why should I seek these things? In a way, they're all laid out for me, but why should I want them? Why should I seek them? And more than just why, he also saw it as a danger. He saw it as a danger to seek those things that were all laid out in front of him, because attachment to those things would just lead him in frustration. They would just lead him in going in the old habits again and again and again with no spiritual progression. He saw that if he, seeking for those things all laid out in front of him, was looking for security where security could not be found. No matter how much money his dad had, no matter how much, how beautiful his wife, how beautiful the dancing girls, and I assume that once dancing girls are not so beautiful anymore, you can just replace them, which would be jolly handy if you were a Buddha. He saw, well, actually, it's not enough. It's not enough. They don't give you security. They don't give you spiritual progression. And I'm more than this. I'm capable of much, much more than this. And I think that actually a lot of people have that experience. A lot of people have that experience even in childhood. And I know that I certainly had that experience even in childhood. Because in a way, in a way, my family in some ways is the best that I could hope for. My family is a great family. I love my family very, very much. I had a wonderful upbringing. I had parents who loved me so much. My father said that, you know, he loved me and I was very easy to love. And we lived in a nice big house. We're in South London, in the spiritual mecca of Tooting Beck. We had enough money that all myself and my brothers could follow any interest that we wanted to follow. But we didn't have so much money that actually we didn't feel lucky, we didn't feel grateful, that we didn't appreciate what we'd got. My parents really value the culture, the arts. They value travel. My house is, my parents' house still is full of books. Any books on any subject you could think of. My dad's probably got a book about it somewhere. Art, travel, literature, poetry. I was taken to my first opera, I think, when I was about 7. And I remember it well. I had a really good education. My parents encouraged me to be interested in other things. They gave me a great education. And in a way, my conditioning is such that I could have just got a really good job. Actually, that's what I'm made for. I'm made to go to a good university and get a good job. And I've got all my sense faculties. I'm healthy. My conditioning is also saying, get married and have children and have a really good job. That's basically what I'm made for. And that's what was on offer to me. And I realised that, I think probably at about the age of 10, I realised that was what was laid out in front of me. And I asked, well, why? You know, in a way, there's nothing wrong with those things in themselves. Great life. Really, really good life. There's nothing wrong with those things in themselves. But I just had to ask why. And then I had this experience where I was watching the TV and there was the Zeebrugge disaster, which I don't know if you remember. A lot of people died because the ferry opened and the ferry got flooded and quite a few people died. And it really struck me that those people were like me, that they had the same life opportunities sort of thrown open in front of them. Some of them had taken those life opportunities. And they were just like me, and they just never knew that death was just around the corner. And I was really in floods of tears. And my dad said, you know, he was a bit like, what's going on there? What became very, very clear to me, that I couldn't just block off those people's sufferings because I didn't know them. It wasn't enough for me to do that. And that actually my life had to take into account others and the suffering of others. So in quite a grand style, I went, my grandfather, who I loved very much actually, was on his deathbed. And my mum said, look, this is the last time you're going to see him. So if there's anything you want to say to him, you know, now's your chance. And I said, I just want to say that I'm going to make a vow to be a nun. Which I kind of managed, but not quite. Not the nun bit, and definitely not the Christian nun bit, but there we go. So I think that actually those kind of experiences at quite a young age, even, are quite common in people. And what happened is, in a way for me, a longing arose in me at that point, maybe even before, a longing arose in me for something more. For, you could even say, the noble quest. For something much, much more than that life that was laid out for me. And that longing has never, ever diminished. That's what's very interesting. It's never diminished. In fact, it's only got stronger. And I think this is like the Buddha. Like the Buddha, I think what moves me most about this sutta, about the noble quest, is this longing. This seeking. Suppose that I seek the unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, and undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Suppose I do that. And what the Buddha had, in a way, was he had a vision. He had a vision of the limitations of what was on offer. And also he saw the freedom. He saw the freedom in another possibility. So I'll read you another bit from the Pali Canon, where he says, before my enlightenment, when I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I thought, house life is crowded and dusty. Life gone forth is wide open. It is not easy living in a household to lead a holy life as utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. Suppose I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and went forth from the house life into homelessness. So he recognized two things. He recognized that the house life is crowded and dusty, and that life gone forth is wide open, utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. So he saw those two things and he had that faith. He had a longing for freedom, a longing for that wide open space, for a life as pure as a polished shell. And what I think's really interesting is, well, where did that vision come from? Because he might have seen kind of religious seekers in his life, but in a way he had this absolute faith that it was possible, and he didn't even realise in a way fully that it was, because there wasn't a Buddha when he was growing up. When he was a young man, there wasn't a Buddha. He didn't even know about the Buddha. It wasn't like here, where you can kind of come to a meditation class, we talk about the Buddha, and we tell you about ethics, and we describe the Buddha, and we talk about kind of enlightened figures throughout history. He didn't have any of that. But yet he had this yearning. He had this absolute faith that something greater was possible. And where did it come from? So Atra on Saturday, this has been doing this meditation course, and I don't know where he got it from, but he had this rather nice phrase. Sometimes Atra comes out with these kind of nice phrases, and then I kind of think, what does that mean? And he had this nice phrase of a memory of something yet to happen. And I thought, oh yeah, well I can kind of get that in my experience, a memory of something yet to happen. And maybe it's a bit like, well, you long for enlightenment because something in you knows that it's possible, something even in a peculiar way has a memory of it. And something in you resonates with enlightenment because it's a possibility for you, and you know it's a possibility for you, and that you know that you'll never be satisfied until you achieve it. So Sangharakshita talks about this a bit in the Bodhisattva Ideal series of lectures. And he says, if it is possible to know that one is on the path to enlightenment, it can only be because there is something within one already, however embryonic, that corresponds to what is fully developed in the Buddha. So however embryonic it is, there is something in one that corresponds to enlightenment itself, that resonates with enlightenment, that knows that enlightenment is possible. It's a very, very mysterious thing. It's very mysterious for the Buddha. But within us there is a knowing. And I sometimes catch this longing. There's a knowing and there's also a longing for what is possible. And it's expressed not just in Buddhism, but actually I think in all religions, and also in novels, in poetry, in music. Sometimes you just get what sometimes described, I think Victor Hugo described it as a longing for what is infinite. Something in those things, there's a longing for what is infinite, which is part of the human experience. And this is what this title of the sutta, I think, means, because Arya means noble, and Pariyasana is from a root meaning desire, which is interesting because, of course, being a good Buddhist, we're meant to be sort of anti-desire or something. But what it's saying is that it means a search, a desiring search, a longing search, an intense search. So Arya, noble, Pariyasana, intense, longing, passionate search. That's what that means. And that's what the Buddha was, life was about. And the Buddha lived by that vision. For the rest of his life, he lived by that vision. He completely stepped outside the familiar. He completely stepped outside, looking always to reinforce his own habits. And there's this beautiful thing where he talks about his life before he was enlightened. He says, I was delicate, most delicate, supremely delicate, Lily pools were made for me at my father's house solely for my benefit. Blue lilies flowered in one, white lilies in another, red lilies in a third. I used no sandalwood that was not from Benares. My turban, tunic, lower garments and cloak were all made of Benares cloth. A white sunshade was held over me day and night so that no cold or heat or dust or grit or dew might inconvenience me. I had three palaces, one for the winter, one for the summer, and one for the rains. In the rains palace I was entertained by minstrels with no men among them. For the 4 months of the rain I never went down to the lower palace, though meals of broken rice with lentil soup are given to the servants and retainers in other people's houses. In my father's house, white rice and meat were given to them. And in the midst of all this luxury, he completely left it all. And it said that when he first begged, and in those days he'd beg for food, you'd have one bowl, you'd get everything in that one bowl. And he made this point that he would beg from anybody, no matter what walk of life they came from. And it said that when he first got this bowl of food, he vomited. He'd never tasted anything like it before. He'd been used to white rice and meat, and here was just the dregs, people's leftovers. So he completely, radically put into effect his vision, which is amazing, because I think that takes incredible courage. You know, most of us, when we feel that longing, when we feel longing for what is possible, when we get an inkling of the heights which we can really reach, most of us try and cover up that experience. We watch the TV, we get drunk, I don't know, whatever our little comfort thing is, we just go and search for sex or whatever. Most of us try and get rid of that longing. It seems too much for us. And there's many, many times in my life where I've just wished it wasn't there, actually. I've just wished that I could just be satisfied with what my family were presenting me. So most of the time we try and get rid of this longing. It's too much. It's unbearable. But the Buddha actually just acted it out with this tremendous conviction that something was possible. And in the sutta itself, he says, later, while still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessing of youth, in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness. So there he was. His parents were weeping with tearful faces. And as Gukhi Vajra said on Saturday, you know, the early followers of the Buddhists, when they say shave, they don't mean with a razor, apparently. They mean they get their fingers and just cut it off with a knife. And so they kind of must have just looked so awful. You know, it wasn't like kind of, I have a vision of monks in Thailand or something with these very clean shaved heads. They just must have looked the most unkept rag bag people ever. And that's what the Buddha must have just looked like. He just must have looked like a rag bag, like a tramp, you know, not like a spiritual wanderer, like a tramp. So off he went, and what did he do? What did the first thing he did? Well, he went to try and find a sangha. He went to try and find a community of people who thought the way he did. And it said that he found two teachers, and it was the same story for both of those teachers. With both of those teachers, he learnt the letter of what they said, learnt the letter of what they taught. He recited it. He understood it. As far as lip reciting and rehearsal of the teaching went, I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed, I know, I see. But he realized he needed to know more than the words, that words are only an expression of an experience, and he needed to find that experience. So he decided that he would try and find, he would try and realize for himself the experience that his teachers were alluding to. He says, I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration and wisdom. Suppose I realize with direct experience what they teach. And he does. In both of those cases, he realized the fruits of all that they taught. And the fruits of all that they taught were the sphere of no thingness and the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. So there you go. It's pretty hard to actually understand what those words mean, let alone what the experience is. But suffice to say, this evening, without going on about it too much, that they're very high states of meditation. And they're so high states of meditation that self and other starts to break down, so that you can't ultimately distinguish between things or even your own perception. What's even your own perception? So what's interesting, so these are the higher states of meditation. And according to Sangharakshita, the objective counterparts to those states of meditation are the God realm. So what that's saying is that if the Buddha died at this point, he would get reborn into the God realm. In a way, his mental states were that of a god. That was how high he went in meditation. He went so high that both of his teachers said, listen, you know, you've got the same experience that I've got. Come and lead this community with me. And on both occasions, he refused. And he refused, saying, this teaching does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana. Not being satisfied with that teaching, disappointed with it, I left. So basically, in a way, what the Buddha found was it wasn't enough. He'd got into these really exalted states of concentration, of meditation, and it wasn't enough. Actually, what he was doing is he was only refining the self. He was just getting very, very good, very subtle level of experiences. He was refining his sensory experience, but he wasn't leaving his sensory experience behind. It wasn't liberation. It was wonderful. It was magical. But it was not liberation. And what I find tremendous is that the Buddha could recognize that it wasn't liberation. You know, if that happened to me, you know, well, pretty much actually if I got into first dhyana more than I do, for those of you who knows what that means, if I got into that state, if I was just concentrated, I would be like, whoopee ding, I'm so special, you know, would like make my century. And there was the Buddha in the sphere of no thingness. And neither perception nor non-perception, which was basically the highest that anyone had gone. And he realized that it wasn't liberation. He was a god. He was actually in the mental states of a god, and he realized it wasn't liberation. He was offered fame. He was offered status. He was even offered happiness. In a way, if you were in those states all the time, you would be completely happy. You wouldn't need anything else. And it wasn't enough because it wasn't liberation. So Sangharakshita says, well, the worldly minded person thinks in terms of happiness. The spiritually minded person thinks in terms of liberation. And I think what that means for us is that it's not enough to just become happy and healthy. You know, Buddhism really helps you do that. Buddhism really helps you to become integrated, happy, healthy, positive, pleasant, intelligent, integrated human beings. It's a wonderful thing. It just gives you a great, you know, it makes you into a great person. But what this is saying is, it's not enough. Even if you get great meditations, you know, even if you're the bee's knees on that cushion, I'm not sure that really works as an expression, but there we go. Even if you're like a spiritual whiz kid, whatever you think you are, even if you've got all those things, it's not enough. In a way, all those things are just a springboard for liberation. So yes, it would be great if everyone became much more happy, healthy, positive, nice to each other, integrated, mindful, all those things. It would be great if that could happen. But when that does happen to you, don't give up, because you're much more than that. And actually, all those things are just a springboard for something much deeper, for actual liberation. And until you reach that liberation, don't stop. Don't rest. Don't even rest with a great meditation. Because all those things just mean that you have a responsibility to go deeper, a responsibility not just for yourself, but for others as well. You know, I think it's worth reflecting on that you're capable of so much. You're capable of the best that the universe has to offer. You are capable of absolute liberation from whatever the world throws at you. You're capable of infinite compassion, infinite wisdom, infinite energy. You're capable of the great love that sees no difference between self and other, that loves people no matter what they do, whose love is infinitely broad and infinitely deep. You are capable of that. And don't stop until you realise those things. Don't rest for second best. That's what the Buddha says. You know, because it's very easy to just stop. Just, you know, when things get all right. You know, a lot of people come to the Buddhist Centre because they're suffering. I certainly came to the Buddhist Centre because I experienced suffering. But then if you just stop when everything kind of gets a bit easier and you become all right, you're missing out on the true treasure. You're not getting the true treasure. And the Buddha did this. He did not rest. He could have had it all. He could have had the pinnacle of what the world had to offer in terms of riches and beauty. He had the pinnacle of what spiritual life had to offer even. And both of those, neither of those were enough for him. So he leaves his teachers, and not a lot is said about the next bit. But he says, still in search of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I wandered by stages through the Magadan country until eventually I saw an agreeable piece of ground, a delightful grove with a clear flowing river with pleasant smooth banks and a nearby village for alms. And it was at this point that he gained enlightenment. So it's very simple. In a way, his enlightenment experience is called a lot of different things in different contexts. And here it's very, very simple, actually. And I think all the different descriptions of enlightenment experience give you a flavour that actually it wasn't one experience. It was an unfolding of experiences that he described differently on different occasions. But in this sutta, it says, being myself subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, sorrow and defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, sorrow and defilement, seeking the unborn, unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, undefiled, supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the unborn, unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, undefiled, supreme security from bondage, nibbana. The knowledge and vision arose in me. My deliverance is unshakable. This is my last birth. Now there is no renewal of being. It was done. The search was over. He did what he needed to do. My deliverance is unshakable. So like the sutta goes on, there's a lot more about after his enlightenment experience. And what's interesting is the rest of it is about how he taught, how he communicated, not by persuading people, not by trying to hammering home the truth, but by instructing them and teaching them so that they understood for themselves. He saw each being, this is the simile of the lotuses is in this sutta, which Vedanya's done a talk on fairly recently, so I won't go into it. But he saw each being as like a lotus growing up from the mud of humanity, reaching through the water and opening unstained above the water. And he saw that each being was in a different stage of development. But he saw that each person can progress. Wherever they're starting from, they can all progress. And some of them will get the experience that he was alluding to. And there's a beautiful scene of him, you know, he wasn't always believed. The first person he told he was enlightened to just shrugged and walked away. But, you know, Buddha carried on, went to see his ascetic friends, which I talked about a couple of weeks ago. And there's this beautiful scene where he lives in a community with them, with his ascetic friends, or who are no longer ascetic. So he's just living with his friends. He's teaching them all until they understood, until they were liberated themselves, until they reached the end of their noble search. And then he moves on. Then he can move on. But he stays with them, just teaching, leading a communal life until they're free. And it ends with a vision of freedom. It ends with this vision of... he's saying it's a bit like worldly life. You're ensnared. You're like a wild deer, a forest deer, ensnared by craving, ensnared by always looking for pleasure, always looking for security in things that can't give you security. And that through meditation, you can be free. You can be like a deer who's not snared, who's not just waiting for the hunter to come and pick him off, who can walk confidently, stand confidently, sit confidently, lie down confidently. You can be completely free. That's what's on offer for you here. You can achieve freedom. But looking at the story of the Life Buddha, I think what's clear is that in order to achieve that freedom, you have to start off with that noble search. You have to start off with a longing for what is possible, with a momentum of intention for what is possible, with a passionate search for liberation. And it's through that passionate search that you can find what you're looking for. So I thought actually I'd just end with a poem by Sangharakshita. I don't do this very often because I find them incredibly hard to read. But we decided in the team meeting we like this, so I'll read it. It's called The Lotus of Compassion. And it says, "The lotus blooms tonight, the great golden lotus of the Lord's compassion, with white roots deep in the slime of this sad world, and huge green leaves spread on the surface of the waters of the Lake of Tears. And surrounded by myriads of silver lotus buds, like white hands folded in prayer for succor from the miseries of this world, that lotus blooms tonight. Oh, leave the crowded shore where men buy and sell. Shake off the soft, detaining fingers of your friends. And in a little boat, at midnight, when the moon is full and glitters at you from the water, row swiftly to the quiet heart of the lake where the lotus blooms, the great golden lotus of the Lord's compassion. And you will feel the sweetness ineffable of its heart's fragrance, coming on a breeze which ripples the face of the silent waters to meet you beneath the stars."